and to spend some time with them. And boy, when I was new, I never thought I would want to spend time with an old timer or somebody that was a baseball coach of mine and yelled at me all the time. To be able to sit on an airplane with him and make him feel comfortable and share a little fellowship on the way up and have some fellowship as we walk back and forth from our hotel and come here and have the fellowship. And when they read the preamble, I was listening that you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women. It doesn't say it's a therapy, it's a fellowship of men and women. And I need the fellowship. I need to be here with you to share my experience, strength, and hope with you so that I can stay, so that hopefully you can stay. And I've been taught here to give it away if I want to keep it. And I am privileged, and thank you to the committee for allowing me to come up here and see beautiful Oregon. I never have been here in my trials and my travels, and I missed Nirvana. It was right here, and I missed it. Lewis and Clark ended up here. They were some of my childhood heroes. And if I would have known that, I don't know. You probably have a different speaker tonight. I probably would have found Nirvana and walked into the ocean. I don't know. But Alcoholics Anonymous has been my life for 13 years, 7 months, and 18 days. And it's a day at a time. Because when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't even willing to cut down. I didn't really know what I was in for, but I knew one thing. I had nowhere else to go. So if you're new and you have nowhere else to go, I know how you feel. I welcome you. It's a great place to start from. You don't have to know anything. It's a wonderful place to be. And I was blessed to fall into an active group of alcoholics working the program in Los Angeles. And I am still, that is my home group today, the Pacific Group, and I am proud of it. And it's where I go every Wednesday night and every Saturday night. And it's where I am allowed to be able to give it away. It's where I'm allowed to be one of you. It's where I feel the fellowship when we say the Lord's Prayer at the end of the meeting. It's where I feel safe. It's where I get my answers so that I can go out in that world one more day and be an example, whether they know I'm being one or not. I'll tell you, the world is a lot better place that I'm sober than it was before. And I'm sure Seaside, Oregon is happy that we're all sitting in here sober tonight. Spending our money on other things. You know, I grew up in Iowa, and I don't know about you, but that was my first resentment where I realized I was landlocked. And my family, I've heard it a lot. You know, I've heard it a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous because you hear the other side of it, and I've heard it a lot this weekend. I come from a wonderful family. I am the middle of 3 sisters, and I've got a younger brother, and they're all very successful. They're all very normal. Nobody drank to excess. Nobody abused one another to excess. They loved me. They gave me a lot. But for me, it was never enough. For me, I always waited for the spaceship to land to say, "You can come home now, Sharon." I always felt out of place in my own skin, with my own family, in my hometown, in my home state. I always felt out of place. And at 13 and 14 years old, when I discovered alcohol, and I went out that night vowing to my good friend Beth that I wasn't going to drink or smoke cigarettes. I'll tell you, I hardly had hit that door than I was learning how to hold the can of beer just so and hold the cigarette just so. And once I got it in me, once I felt what it did for me, I danced with the football players that night. I grew boobs. My knock-knees straightened right back out. I went into a blackout. I drove a lot of people home. I didn't know how to drive yet, and I had a great time. I woke up with remorse and guilt and what happened, and I couldn't wait to do it again. I was hooked. And that was the way I drank. I drank to get drunk. I drank for the feeling. Alcohol did something for me that it didn't do for some other people I drank with. And as my alcoholism progressed, I found the people I drank like I drank. I mean, we're real good at that. We can sniff them out, just like the victim can find the victimizer in a room full of crowded people. I would walk into a bar dressed to the teeth, looking good, and the sickest guy in that whole place would find me. And I couldn't figure out how he could find me, you know, like magnets. And I was a victim for an awful long time, even into my sobriety. And Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a lot of choices in my life that I didn't have before. I went to college because you did that in my family. Now, I got in a little trouble in high school, but it was no real big trouble. And, you know, the sheriff drove me home and talked to my father. And I told my father I didn't know the beer was there. And, you know, I was real good at it. I was real good at covering up and lying and living a double life. And I went into that confessional, and, you know, on Saturday morning, like all of us good Catholics did, and I was in there for 30 seconds and back out, because if I was in there longer than 30 seconds, I was a bad girl. And I had that down. I would tell that priest, so many here, so many there, so many there, and I would be back out to my 10 Hail Marys and feel for a moment like I was pure and whole and I could go out for Saturday night and get it on again, you know? And I was real good at that. I was real good at keeping what was happening in my life that day. It's very hot. Maybe it's hot. Hot. Any water? Excuse me a minute. It's just the picture. There's no glass. I guess they know me. I got mine. I went off to college because you did that in my family, and my dad was paying for the bill, and I was going to get married to this guy, and I caught him with his tutor, and I had my heart broken, and I started to really drink a lot of alcohol, and I started to take something, I was taking diet pills, and I was starting to smoke grass, and there was a lot happening in the late 60s when I went off to college, and it wasn't education. It was, they were having a lot of fun on the other side of that footbridge, and they were mad. They seemed like they were angry, but they were loaded all the time, and they were having fun. So I dropped out of education, and I went into art as a major. And we did things like get very loaded and roll on the campus, on the canvas, and make these big paintings, body paintings, we called them. And my father came down to see me after I had this suicide attempt. I don't know why. I just had this suicide attempt one morning. I woke up and I thought it'd be a good idea to cut my wrists. I was always dramatic, I guess. And I called my dad, and he came down to see me, and he brought the family priest down to see me. And the priest and I got drunk, and my father shook his head, and he didn't know what to do with me. And I used to go to a lot of those riots and get tear gassed, and then I'd have another reason to be mad at you and be mad at the government. And I was just drinking and taking a lot of drugs, and I didn't care about myself or the education that was being handed to me. My dad and I had a falling out. I think I woke him up one too many times at 4 in the morning with my new best friend, and we had big eyes because we were probably taking 16 hits of orange sunshine, which was acid, and I would wake up my parents and try to have these deep and meaningful discussions with them. And they didn't understand, you know? These are the salt of the earth type of people, and they didn't understand. And my dad that spring put my bags on the steps and said, pay for your own education or get out. And I wasn't going to go to work, to go to school, because I wasn't going to school. I was having fun, I thought. And I thought, well, okay, I went to the Big Apple. I went to New York City. I got a job. I took a lot of drugs. I drank two-hour lunches with these people in the advertising agency. We nursed each other's hangover. We took care of one another. I took a lot of crystal amphetamines, and I drank every day and every night. And every Friday night, I went to have the bumps on my head read in this bar. I went to see a phrenologist to tell me my future. I did the I Ching. I hung out with a Scientologist. I was in the tarot. And I was looking for the answer. I was on my search for truth. And I did that. I did that until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was on a search for truth, you know. And to me, I always wanted what you had. It always looked better, you know. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and a guy named Norm told me the reason the other guy's grass was greener was because he took care of his lawn. That's what the speaker said. And I said, yeah, okay. That made sense. And I've learned here how to tend my own lawn. I've learned here how to take care of myself and work on me and leave you alone. And I went crazy in New York, and I ended up in Colorado because I wanted to be a cowboy. And I started taking my geographics. I'm a runner. I like the wind at my back, my thumb out, my dog at my heels, my backpack on, and I'm gone. And that's the way I lived a lot of my life, was over there. It looked better over there. I didn't know it was dragging me and all my defects with me. I didn't know it was dragging the sick alcoholic with me. And I was in Colorado, near Aspen, Colorado, for a couple of months. I had this nice job. I was fitting in. I was behaving. And this guy walked into the restaurant I was working in, and he looked like my hero, Bob Dylan. I didn't ask any questions. He ordered a chocolate milkshake to go. I made two chocolate milkshakes to go, and I came to California with him. That was my keen alcoholic thinking. That's the way I lived my life. And I ended up at the commune. I thought the commune was the answer in Huntington Beach. And we didn't do anything, but, I mean, there was pot everywhere. There was the crunchy granola pot. There was the stems that you put inside the spaghetti sauce. I mean, you didn't throw anything away. We had a big jug of wine always going at the kitchen table, and pot and everything we ate. And all we did was cook and drink wine. We were mellow. We were very mellow. I was here for about 4 months. I came with $2. I left 4 months later with $5 and a dog, and I thought, boy, what a time I had. I turned 21 in Westwood with the Krishnas, the Hare Krishnas, because, you know, they spotted that hole in my psyche. Everybody always spotted that hole in my psyche. Wherever I was, these groups wanted to bring me in, and it was always forever. And I said, I don't do forever. I'll do tonight and have a good time. I'm not going to change my name and give up my worldly possessions forever. And I came back to Colorado, and I was a very sick girl. I was 21 years old. I ended up with my mom and dad in Iowa that year. I was a full-blown alcoholic, and nobody knew it. Nobody knew it. I went to the family doctor who gave me Valium for my nerves because I was living at home with mom and dad again. And I didn't speak to my father. My father didn't speak to me. And my mother was constantly trying to keep us apart because it was a shouting, violent, awful thing between me and my father for years. And I went into the taverns in that small town, and I'd sit there and drink. And I'd look at the losers at the end of the bar every night, judging them. You know, I'm in there judging them every night. I'm very sick, and I met my new answer, and my new answer was 6'8" tall. He walked in, he had big eyes. He was wearing Indian gauze clothing that would kind of waft in the wind. And he was peaceful, and his name was Phil. And he had his own mantra. And he took me off to northern Wisconsin to an organic farm. And he was going to help me. How they say it, Vince, help me. He was going to help me. And I was very ill, but they found out I had a non-functioning gallbladder and pancreatitis. And they said, do you drink any excess alcohol? Do you take any excessive drugs? I said, well, I have a couple of beers a week. I mean, that's as honest as I could really tell them. And they did some surgery on me, and I got a little bit better. And Phil went to work in some sort of a welding place, and I spent my days reading Mother Earth News and Yul Gibbons and how to eat right and be healthy and all those kind of things, and paint the mailboxes. I used to paint all the neighborhood mailboxes, you know, and I was stoned all the time. And he didn't like me to get drunk. He gave me lots of pot, he took away my nicotine cigarettes, and he gave me little tiny bottles of dandelion wine, organic wine. And I would sit there and look at this little bottle of dandelion wine thinking, well, that's fine for before dinner for me, but what about during dinner and then tonight? And when I got drunk, Phil would give me that look. You know that look? That judgmental, raised eyebrow look. And my mother had given me that look. You know, the family priest had given me that look. My dad had given me that look. The teachers had given me, all those people that said, you have so much potential, what's wrong with you, had given me that look. My sisters had given me that look. People that I had disappointed had given me that look. And Phil gave me that look one too many times, one more night. And it was going to snow again, and I was going to have to sit there and watch him learn to play the banjo with Pete Seeger. He used to put that record on and take out his little banjo, and he would... It goes like this. Pete Seeger says, okay, it goes bum-titty, bum-titty, and they did that for like 10 minutes together, Pete Seeger and Phil on the banjo. And I started to get that taste in my mouth and that itchy feeling in my hands and under my feet, And I got in the car, they had the big sun painted on the hood. I was into painting everything. We had 50 head of organic sheep, and if they would have stood still long enough, I would have painted them. So I painted the barn, I painted everything. And I went into town, I got me 2 big gallons of cheap white wine. And I came home, and Phil gave me that look, and went to bed, and that banjo went across the room, and the Rolling Stones came out and put them on the record player. And me and the cat and the dog and my wine had a party. We had a lot of fun. That bum titty didn't bother me anymore. And he woke up about 4 in the morning, and he gave me that look, and as I can remember it, as I it's almost like I was there. I can remember making the decision. That's a good step. I think I was there. I can feel myself making that decision now, because he looked at me and my head said, come spring when I don't need you anymore, alcohol wins. And it did. Come spring, I drove him away. They were all into primal therapy, and I was blackballed by the organic farmers because I wasn't going to do it. I wanted to drink in the bars with my money. Now, I don't know how many people have been blackballed by an organic community, but I was. And me and the sheep and the dog and the cat and the horse drank like I wanted to drink. And I was alone except for my friend Clarence the farmer. And Clarence had his license revoked for having too many drunk driving arrests, so he drove his tractor. And he was my pal. And he would bring the booze every single night. And I could see that tractor winding its way up the drive, and I would just think, oh, thank God Clarence is here. You know, I didn't care. He liked me to play this big pink piano I had. And so I play the piano, and we get drunk, and we usually both cry. And sometimes Clarence would put in his teeth, and sometimes he wouldn't put in his teeth. And we were happy, you know? And then his wife got a little upset, so I had to give up Clarence. And, see, when Phil left, he had left me with something which I thought was a lot of class. You know, we sold the farm and we split the money and all that, and we signed it over to the next organic farmer. That was the thing, you had to keep it with organic people. And he had left me a half acre of marijuana we had planted way back in the woods. And the garden I planted went to weeds, but the marijuana patch was weeded. I went out there every day. There was not one tiny shoot of weed that grew in that patch, because I lived out there that summer. And it was 12 feet tall when I finally harvested it. And it was wonderful stuff. I would go out there and have lunch. I would just sit there and eat. You know? And I really was pretty content until I realized winter was coming. And I don't know if you know northern Wisconsin, but it gets cold up there. And we had this wood, all we did was heat with wood. You had to chop the wood, buzzsaw the wood, and split the wood. We made maple syrup that year. And God, I remember I was out there in the snow, stuck up to my thighs. He was 6 feet 8 inches tall. He'd walk right through the crust of the snow, and I had these heavy barrels. Buckets of sap, and I'd be stuck out in the snow freezing to death. I'd go, what am I doing here? I mean, it was insane, and I didn't want to spend one more winter like that. And so I harvested my pot, and I was going to sell it all and get out of town. And for 3 days, I obsessively harvested this stuff by horseback. And I did it right so that you put the boiling water on the wood stove, and you put the roots in it, and it shoves the THC to the top, and all this stuff. And you hang it upside down in the machine shed, and I did this for 3 days. And I was drinking and eating it and rubbing on it and just into it, you know? And I went to turn my first dope deal in this big town of Menominee, 45 miles away. And I go and I knock on the door, and I hadn't met these people, and you say the right passwords. And you said the right passwords, and I walk in, and he said, okay, well, where's the stuff? And I looked at my dog, and my dog looked at me, and we forgot it. We left it back on the farm. We forgot it. I was embarrassed, and I joined the carnival that night. It was in town. It was in town. Big answer. So I called my mother somewhere in Arkansas and told her I was running this great shooting gallery and making a lot of money, and my mother started to cry. So now I just don't even call home anymore. I can't talk to my dad. I disappoint my mother. And I just stopped calling home for the next 4 years. In Bogalusa, Louisiana, they stuck me in maximum security for drugs. They busted me for drugs. And they busted me and my new boyfriend and the skunk and the snake and the dog. And they put us all in jail in Franklinton Parish. And they fed me grits for 31 days. And I got drunk in jail. I got high in jail. I didn't even think not to. I did what you did. And when they sent me loose, I found New Orleans. And they said, don't leave the state, kid, because you're going to have to come back up here and go to court. And I found New Orleans, and I found home. I sniffed my way to that French Quarter. It's 12 blocks by about 8 blocks wide. And I found home. And now I'm afraid to take any drugs, so I'm drinking very hard and heavy. And I found my new true love that, I mean, it was great for 2 weeks, and for the next 4 years, sometimes he'd work and sometimes he wouldn't work. His name was Jose. It was Jose Cuervo Gold. And I drank tequila because I was listening to a man talk at our group, our home group, and he was very educated, very Irish. He was an actor, and he had just this nice way about him. He was talking about how he drank martinis and the crackle of the martini and how it would crackle in the glass and how it made him feel better as soon as he heard that crackle. And I thought, yeah, that's the way martinis were. They kind of crackled. I thought, how did Jose Cuervo Gold sound? And I was lying there. Just a couple nights later, and I heard this guy trying to start a Harley about 2 blocks away. And I thought, you know how you lay there and you hear them and they kickstart it and it doesn't go, and they get it again and it doesn't go, and you're just, you know, you're salivating waiting to hear that big sound, and then he gets it on the third time. It just fills the whole block up with that great sound. That's the way Jose Cuervo worked for me. It just kickstarted me. And now when I'm drinking, I am not a lot of fun to be around all the time. You don't quite know which way my mood is going to go. And I was a dancer for a while on Bourbon Street. Did you see that? Nice flashback? No. It's a big bomber fly, I think. I danced on Bourbon Street. Johnny didn't see a shit, Johnny. When I drank the last couple years, I bloated up. I don't know about you. I didn't eat that much. I would sometimes come to out of a blackout with some go food in my face in it or something, but I bloated up. I mean, I swear I could look at my arm and show you a drink I had 2 years ago. I mean, that's just the way my body did not... It was so toxic from alcohol. And I was dancing on this bar on Bourbon Street, and they had this baby grand piano. I would come out and do my routine, and I'm about 170 pounds, see? And I would stuff me in these costumes and these fishnet stockings. And I would get stuck on this palm tree, the staples on this palm tree, the props. So I would be there with my fishnet stuck on the props, thinking, okay, what do I do? Because if I rip it away, I mean, all the fat comes out of the hole in the fishnets. Sometimes I would just slither around on this palm tree, you know? And sometimes I'd say, what the hell? It depends on how much I had a drink, and I'd rip it out, and the flesh would come out. But I'd do my number, and I usually would land in your lap, and they fired me. That's the only job I got fired from on the spot. It wasn't that I quit your fired number. I was real good at that. So I became a bartender, and I was a good bartender, and, you know, I pour you a drink, I pour me a drink. I got fired from one of the nicer hotels for being drunk on the job. And I started working the local joints, and now, the local joints, I mean, I have a tab in your place, you have a tab in my place, we take care of one another. And there were places called, like, the Bastille and Funky Butts, and places like that, you didn't know if it was daytime or nighttime. And you would sometimes be in there for 2 days. The people would take care of you, pass out, you'd come to, you pass out, you'd come to. I'm feeling kind of secure, so I'm starting to take a lot of drugs. I always had amyl nitrate with me, and always had my bottle of Jose Cuervo Gold. I would be somewhere where people would be buying me drinks, and I would have a quart of Jose Cuervo Gold in my bag. I had to have my alcohol at all times to feel secure. It had to be there. Whether it worked tonight or it didn't work tonight, I had to have it. And I worked a lot of Mardi Gras down there. I remember working one of the Mardi Gras, and I turned around and I looked, and I had gone through a quart and a half of my booze. Nobody touched my booze at my bar. And I didn't touch your booze that you had on your shift. And I had been through a quart and a half, and I thought, that's a lot of booze. My shift wasn't even half over yet. That was just people buying me drinks. And I lived that way, and I got sicker and sicker and sicker, and I had a boyfriend, the guy from the carnival, and we lived above a biker bar called the Mousetrap Bar. And we lived next to Angela, Lady of the Evening, and we lived next to a guy who would drive his bike up the steps and into, you know, into his room. And it was a tar paper roof, and it was a shabby place, and it was filthy, and it was dirty. And they called the police a lot on Kirby and I because we would have knife fights, and the bikers didn't want to deal with us. They just called the police. And, my mom and dad came to visit me about this time, and it was the last time my parents came to see me in my alcoholism. And the thing was they didn't know the disease. They didn't know what was wrong with their daughter. They just thought, God, she's gone. I could see it. My mother, I mean, this guy was a jerk to my father, put the snake in his face. I mean, he called me four-letter words in front of my mother. My mother cried. My dad couldn't look at me. He just flinched his jaw, and they left. And they saw their daughter living in the filth of alcoholism. And they didn't know what it was. And my parents today know what it is. Because of Alcoholics Anonymous and because of me. Because I'm an example to them. I am. And my alcoholism got worse. I had a lot of situations happen. A friend of mine got shot and killed outside my door by the police at Mardi Gras. I walked over his body. I went to New York. I had a nervous breakdown of my sister's. I didn't play the hospital circuit because I didn't know about it. And I just didn't know it. I thought they'd keep me. I always heard the nuns would keep you, you know. So I never played that circuit. And I went to my sister, and I ended up in Barney's Beanery in West Hollywood, down in Los Angeles. I kept ending up down in West Los Angeles, this bar called Barney's Beanery. And I hated this bar because they didn't like me there. Because I wanted to drink after 2 o'clock, you know. They didn't like me there because I would kick a chair up from under one of the patrons and mace him and then stand back and watch what would ensue, you know. I wasn't your friendly Saturday night type drunk. They didn't like me there. But you know what? I know because the seed was planted in that bar. That big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, that big blue book, that was the first time I ever saw that book was in that bar. And it was under a girl's arm by the name of Chris. And she was with another girl and they were too drunk to drive to their ANA meeting. So they called a taxi. And we all cheered them out the door with our doubles, wished them well. And that's all I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought they taught you to drink or something. I had no idea. But Chris planted that seed because on August 20th, when I needed my Eskimo, Chris was my Eskimo. And Chris died of alcoholism about 5 years ago. And I don't know why I'm here and she's not. I really can't tell you that, other than I didn't pick up the first drink. And that's the seriousness of this disease. It will kill you. It will kill you. And one more time, I ended up in New Orleans. One more time, it didn't work out. I was on my way to Hawaii, and I ended up at Barney's Beanery again. The guy left me in some hotel somewhere because I was too sick for him. I was having DTs in Texas. In Texas, I was having DTs. And he didn't want to deal with me, and he left me in this bar. And he left some money at the hotel, and I just thought, what am I going to do? I wanted to go to Hawaii. You know, I wanted to start over in Hawaii one more time. And I got on the back of a bike that night to go to Palm Springs because I'd never been there. And there were a couple of guys in the bar that were on Harleys. And it was windy that night going through the desert. So they said, put the fat one on the back. We need the extra weight. And that's how I got to go. And they took me to this nightclub, and they left me there. I'll tell you, I was just a little bit too much for them. And I'm in and out of a blackout. The last many, many months I drank, I don't even know where I am or if I'm coming or going. And sometimes the alcohol would work and shut the head and the feelings up, and sometimes I would look in that back bar mirror and I would see loser. You know? And that night I was cooking, though. I was having a good time. And these guys left me, and I met two new guys. I think they were the bar boys. I don't really know. But they we went out to have a good time, and their idea of a good time was to break my jaw in three places because I realized this is really happening to me, and that's what they wanted to do. Now, I had been near that kind of situation, but never quite there, and this time it was happening to me. And you know what? I didn't fight. I just let it happen. and they broke my nose, and they busted my face up, and they raped me, and they drugged me around, and had a pretty good time with this beached whale, you know? They couldn't lift me into the car, so they drugged me out on the cement, and they stuck me in the back of this car, drove outside of Palm Springs, California, July 27, 1975, when it's hot, and they rolled me over a cliff and left me there face down to bleed to death. And I should have. I should have, because I didn't have a lot of will to live. Jerome was talking about that will to live. It was gone. I didn't care anymore. But something got me up. Something. I had a little spiritual awakening. I had a little kick that said, get up, I want to live. And I heard that. And I got up. And I got up the side of this hill, and I got down some blacktop road, and I found somebody's condominium. And I guess I tried to wake him up. I don't remember. But the gardener found me passed out in a lawn chair by the pool. 2 feet from the pool. I should have stumbled in that pool, had no control of my face, and drowned to death. But I landed in that lawn chair. I don't know why, other than God had other plans for me. Because when I ended up that morning on the gurney going into surgery, I had another little spiritual awakening. That wasn't me, because, see, I am incapable of being honest with myself. I do not know what it's like to be honest with myself. I couldn't face it. I couldn't feel it. I couldn't do it. What it said to me, this voice said, you know that those guys didn't put you here in this shape. It's not your father's fault or the Catholic Church's fault or because your sister's a Mensa, you know. It's not George who broke your heart or all those other things you drank over all those years or all those people you've been mad at and judging. You put you here, Sharon, and I heard that. I don't know why, but I heard that. And I ended up in intensive care in Palm Desert Hospital. And another thing happened. These events are something that I can't explain. It's just fortuitous events that brought me to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous and gave me the gift. Gave me the gift of life that I had nothing to do with. What I do with it now is up to me. But the gift was given to me freely. And nobody sent me a plane ticket. Nobody came and said, you can come live with me in Arizona. We'll start over. Nobody bailed me out. First time. And this guy that I had known from Barney's Beanery said I could come live with him in West L.A. And I went and lived above the liquor store in West L.A. because I had nowhere else to go. I had to stay in town to go see these doctors and to go back to Palm Springs to go to court because they caught these guys. And I had a lot of stuff going on. And you know what? I was tired. I was real tired. And I had no more of that. It's going to be better in Arizona. It was gone. And I sat there above this liquor store, and I was on a liquid diet because I was wired for sound. I had all these wires on my face. And he was buying me red wine, cheap red wine. And that's what I subsisted on for a couple of weeks. And I knew something. I knew if I didn't drink it, I'd see those funny things. I knew if I did drink it, it wouldn't do me any good anymore. But I drank it anyway because I had no choice. I sat there and sucked on it through the hole in the tooth. And August 20th, he said, Sharon, you just got to leave. Sorry, just got to go. And I called my mother in Iowa, and I called her Colette, because you always want them to know who's calling. And my mother said something to me that if she would have said anything else, I know you'd have another speaker tonight, because she cut me off. She said, Sharon, I can't help you anymore. Why don't you go to the Salvation Army? And if Marge would have said, I'll send you $20 but never call home again, I would have waited Western Union 2 days for $20 and I would be drunk and probably dead. And my mother said, try the Salvation Army. And I knew it was there. And when I hung up the phone, there was a number in front of my face. And I don't know how it got there, but it was Chris's phone number, the girl from Barney's Beanery with the big book under her arm. She'd given me her number at some time. And I thought, well, I'll call Chris. She'll understand. I don't know why. She'll help me. And I called Chris, and Chris said, well, Sharon, I really can't help you, but this girl named Suzanne can. And I thought, what is this? You know? And I ended up calling a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous that morning. And it was a woman named Suzanne who was sober about 5 years, and she instantly read my mail. She said, don't drink anything today and put that pot down. You know? And I thought, how'd she know I was sitting there smoking pot? You know? It's like, I thought she was looking at me from around the corner or something. And she said, these two girls are going to come get you. I want you to go sit on the steps and wait. Well, I don't know why, but I did it. You know, I thought, who is this woman? And I want to meet her. And she's giving me all these orders. So I went down and sat at the foot of the steps. And these two girls got out of a bright yellow Volkswagen. Big California smile, suntan, blonde hair. bright eyes. I mean, it was blinding. It was just blinding. And they stuck me in the back of this Volkswagen where you can't get out. You just can't get out. And every red light, they'd tell me parts of their story. You know, they would turn around. You know, nobody asked me about me. Nobody said a word about me. And I had this little newspaper clipping in my pocket in case they'd say, what the hell happened to you, you know? But they didn't. They took me to this Echo Park meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous where the Pacific Group met on Wednesday nights. And the man at the door had a tie on, and he said, welcome. And I thought, what? The man with the tie is saying, welcome. And they shuffled me in, and they sat me in the front, and immediately this man came up to me with the 20 questions. It was like they were ready for me. And he looked like my grandfather Wesley, so I thought I'll be nice to him and take this little test. And I passed with 17, and he was so happy. I made his night, you know. Now, one of the ones I said no to, too, was the lower companions one. I mean, I was it. I was the lower companion. And I had nobody to drink with anymore at the end. But I don't remember much of what they did with me. I know they raised my hand for me. I got all this attention. I got handfuls of phone numbers that I crinkled up and put in my pockets. I know that I just couldn't figure out how they all knew I was new. I mean, I just didn't know how they all knew I was new. It was my first time here, you know. And they were kind to me, and they loved me, and they took me back home. I didn't know I was getting the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know that I had gotten a little bit of hope. I didn't know. The man that spoke, I don't remember anything he said other than he had always waited for the spaceship to land and say, you can come home now, Bill. And I thought, yeah, I feel like that. And I had that identification that gave me hope that I wasn't alone anymore. Because I don't know about you, alcoholism to me is a disease of loneliness. I was a member of a lot of things out there, but I didn't belong anywhere. And I belong here, and I know that. I got all my answers right here. My answers are here. They're in Alcoholics Anonymous, they're in the 12 Steps, they're in the Big Book. My search was over. And I didn't know that for quite a while. I was one of those real rummy newcomers that what you said I did, I had no choice. They moved me out of that liquor store. They moved me onto some woman's floor for a week. And then they gave me a sleeping bag, and I moved to another woman's floor for a week. And they just kept me busy. You know, they'd pick me up and take me to noon meetings. They'd drop me off at night and say, don't drink and use anything tonight. We'll pick you up tomorrow, kid. And all these newcomers, I didn't know they were newcomers. I just thought they were nice to me and they liked me. And I found out later that their sponsors were teaching their babies how to work with the newcomers, so they sent them over to the one with the wired-up face in the corner. I got a lot of love and a lot of help. And I was also one of those people that, I washed cups. I was privileged to be at a meeting that still had cups. And you put me in just there with the soapy water and I would just wash cups. You know, I was real good at single thinking. That's all I could do. And this guy from Texas named Mike with a tattooed tear right here. And I didn't like Texans either. I don't know what it is. I identify with you, Vince. But he would stick his finger in my chest and say, did you get a sponsor yet, kid? You know? And he would piss me off. And I go home and think about Mike. And I think, I'm going to get me a sponsor just so I can tell him not to touch me anymore. So I got all those phone numbers out, and somebody had written something nice on her note. And I called that girl up, and I said, will you be my sponsor? And she said, sure. Now, you know what? Motives don't count. And I am so glad, because if I would sit around and wait to have the right motives all the time, I'd be sitting on the edge of my bed waiting. I'd be sitting out there in the world waiting. I get up and I live life today because I was taught that. I was taught to take the action. Even if I was pushed into it, I resented somebody that made me do it, or I was jealous of somebody, so I tried to be just like them. It didn't matter what was important, but I was taking a positive step. I was turning my will and my life over to the care of somebody else. For the first time in my life, I was willing to listen to her judgment over mine. And what she did to me was she moved me from the floor in the sleeping bag to her couch. And that was a spiritual experience. That was a plus for sponsorship. That meant a lot to me. And she also made me read 3 pages of that Big Book every night. She said, don't read any more, don't read any less, read the black and the white, and try to get through 3 pages. And that Big Book put me to sleep every single night. And she also made me do something else that I didn't like, get on my knees and say thank you. And I learned to do that because she told me to do that, because I was staying at her house, because I knew she was watching me out of the corner of her bedroom, you know, so I did it, you know. And I'll tell you, when that guy Mike came up to me and stuck his finger in my chest, I told him to back off. I had a sponsor. Made me feel good. My life in Alcoholics Anonymous started very slowly. Like I said, I had nothing when I got here. I had two paper bags of mismatched goods and this borrowed sleeping bag and a big book they gave me that I gave them my last quarter for, because you're not going to give me anything. You know, the arrogant, sick, stay away from me pride. You know, I'm sitting there in broken down Huarache shoes and t-shirts with bleach stains and blue jeans I'm coming out of, and you're not going to give me anything. You know, what do you want for it? And somebody one night told me what they wanted for it. They wanted me to give it away. Someday, when I can, pass it on. That's what we want you to do with it, Sharon. And that made some sense to me. The silly cliches that Vince was talking about, they had to be explained to me. I remember somebody said, do you want to ride to tomorrow night's meeting? And see, I was wired for the first 3 months I was here, so I didn't talk. It was great, you know. I had these clamps on my mouth, so my ears had to open. You know, I learned to listen. I was beaten teachable, and I was learning to listen. And what happened was, this guy asked me if I wanted to ride, and I said, it's a day of a time. I couldn't figure it out. It was so confusing. And an old-timer heard me. And he took me to the side, and he said, you know, are you okay right now, kid? Are you all right right now? And, you know, you have to stand there with these newcomers sometimes with their Rolodex brain kind of spins. See where it's going to land. And they were kind to me, and they waited for me to say that newcomer phrase, fine. I didn't feel anything, I'm fine. And he said, well, that's what I mean. Look at my calendar. I've got plans next month. I've got plans next week. You can make those kind of plans, but emotionally, we just handle today. If you're okay right now, take a deep breath and be okay. You're all right right now. And so I got it. It was explained to me in simple, simple terms. And after the wires came off, I had to go to work. They believe in being self-supporting. I used to kind of slide up to these guys that looked like they'd have a little money, and they'd give me a handful of change, and they'd say, call your sponsor, kid, and they'd laugh at me. I thought, how do they know I'm trying to run a game on them? They were just like me.
You. At this time, please stop your machine and turn the tape for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this time, please.
Right now, kid? Are you all right right now? And you know, you have to stand there with these newcomers sometimes with their Rolodex brain kind of spins. To see where it's going to land. And they were kind to me, and they waited for me to say that newcomer phrase, fine. I didn't feel anything, I'm fine. And he said, well, that's what I mean. Look at my calendar. I've got plans next month. I've got plans next week. You can make those kind of plans, but emotionally, we just handle today. If you're okay right now, take a deep breath and be okay. You're all right right now. And so I got it. It was explained to me in simple, simple terms. And after the wires came off, I had to go to work. They believe in being self-supporting. I used to kind of slide up to these guys that looked like they'd have a little money, and they'd give me a handful of change, and they'd say, call your sponsor, kid, and they'd laugh at me. I thought, how do they know I'm trying to run a game on them? They were just like me.
You. At this.
All lined up. So I had to go out there and be a food waitress, and I had a rotten attitude. I didn't want to serve you food, and it showed, and I didn't make any tips. You know, I didn't like my job. Nobody gave me any money, and they asked me one night, how's it going? How's your job going? And I said, crappy, I'm not making any money. And they said, well, are you faking it till you feel it? I said, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. This is to let everybody know how you feel. It's an honest program. I mean, I went out there on interviews and told them parts of my story, and they would sit there for 2 hours, fascinated, and never call me. Never, ever call me back. They said, no, you got to fake it till you feel it. It's okay to be that way. And they took this woman over, and they brought a woman over to me who was an Al-Anon, and they showed me how to do this. Big smile, big phony smile. My tips got better. And I learned another clue to living life. You know, they don't care how you feel out there. They just want the job done, you know? I run in here sometimes and tell you how I feel. I can't wait to come here and tell you how I feel. I don't call my mother at 4 in the morning to tell her that I'm afraid to fly, so I'm never going to wear polyester because it'll stick you when you burn. You know, I don't do that to my mom, you know? I can come in here and tell you we laugh about it. You know how I feel. You know, this is my family of understanding, you know. Those people out there, they don't care about how I feel. They care about what I do. And I learned an important lesson. I used to call my sponsor, and I'd be crying on my waitress shoes in the morning, and I'd tell her, I don't feel good. I think I have the brain tumor. You know, I was always having the brain tumor. And she'd say, I don't care how you feel. You show up. If you die at work, we'll give you an AA funeral. You know, if you die at home, forget it. And she'd hang up the phone, you know. I wake her up at 6 in the morning to tell her this crap, you know. Janet was great. She was half Mexican, half Indian, and she didn't take a lot of my crap, you know. She used to lecture me, and I would just hold the phone out to hear and make faces at her on the phone, and she didn't know I did that. Who loses? I lose. Right? I don't hear what she's saying, you know. And then later on in life, you got to watch out what you do to your sponsor because it gets done to you. I used to have this baby. When I would give her direction, I would hear this crunching on the phone. One day I said, Beth, what are you doing? She said, I'm eating a carrot. She would sit there and eat carrots at me when I give her directions. So watch out what you do to your sponsor. It comes back. But Janet made me go to work because she pissed me off, and I go out there and I think I'm going to do everything she tells me to do, because at 5 o'clock when I get home and call her and tell her I had a crappy day, I did everything you told me to do, I followed these principles, I did what you said, and I had a crappy day. You know, but I get there and I do what you say and I start to feel better and the day is all good and I come home and I feel pretty good and forget about all of it. Motives don't count. What was important was I suited up and I showed up no matter how I felt. And I do that with my commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous, no matter how I feel. Janet did the third step with me on our knees with her arms around me and made her night. I didn't feel anything. I do it with my babies on our knees, and they sometimes look at me funny like, okay, you're enjoying this. Doesn't mean anything to me yet. But it was a start for me. And I was standing outside the Thursday night meeting one night, and she was screaming at me to get a God. I don't care what it is, Sherman, you got to get a God. You know, you're just aimlessly out there. And Beacon's moving van drove by at that moment. And so I thought, okay, I'll pick Beacon. It made sense. And so I felt like this piece of bureau that had been shuffled around the country, and maybe it was like a scratched or a novice author. It was crooked, but they always, you know how they wrap them in those quilted things, and they always make it to their destination? Well, that's the way this mind worked. I thought, God was like Beacon. And I moved around, and he took care of me, and I made it to my destination. I don't know about you, but I prayed to Beacons for a long time, and it worked. It wasn't me. That's the thing, was that it wasn't me. And I was in Houston about 6 months ago, and I was frothing at the mouth, and uptight, the traffic was bad, and I had to make a plane. And right by me on the freeway drives Beacon. And I immediately got better. I just immediately got better. It still works for me today. So that was my start with my God. I have since made amends to the Catholic Church. I have a son that's baptized a Catholic. I went back to church. I got remarried in the Catholic Church. I sponsor a nun. They talk about peace and love. I don't know where I was before, but that's what they talk about. That's what I hear now. But I just was so afraid of this God. And God started to become my pal and my friend and somebody I could take with me and talk to in the car. I pray a lot. I pray in the car. I pray in the shower. I pray, you know, when I'm doing the dishes. I pray when I'm driving my car out there. I just pray. I talk to God a lot. I pray. That was the way I started to pray. A lot of my sincere prayers were, screw it. I give up. That was a lot of my sincere third step work. Just screw it. I can't handle it. Screw it. You take it. That's the way. Once I'm back to the wall, I'll give it up. You know, I used to have to go through a lot of pain to give it up. Now, I have to have a little pain to motivate me, but I don't like to beat my head so many times. Because, you know, there's no way around growth to me. You know, you just got to go through it. And I want to stay here and I want to grow because Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't graduate from it. And I've drank and used for more, and I want to stay sober for more. I want more of this life. I want more of this good feeling. I want more understanding of these 12 steps. I want more to get away because then I get more. I just want more. Part of my personality, you know? So if you got to stay here and walk through a little pain and work those steps over and over again and clean house, then you enjoy it, and then you mess it up, and then you clean it, and then you enjoy it, and then you mess it up, fine. That's okay. Because the next plateau is always more enriching and more fulfilling and more filled with new friends. Always. I have never, ever gone backwards in Alcoholics Anonymous working the 12 steps. Never. There has never been a problem here where they said, we haven't had that here. Maybe you should go try another group and another program. Nobody has ever said that to me. They said, so-and-so worked through it, go talk to her. He worked through it, go talk to him. But unless I tell them I'm hurting, nobody knows. Because I can walk around fine all the time. You know? And I get so fine that I get in my room with my big book all alone and all the people in my head talk to me and I'm screwed. You know? I gotta come out here and have a sponsor that knows me. Because between me and my sponsor, no matter who is my sponsor, there is air, there is space. There is not all of me there talking to me, trying to decipher what's the right judgment and what's the wrong instinct and well, we did this in the past and it didn't work and it's just shut up and call you sponsor. You know, it's so much easier. And I have walked behind a sponsor the whole time I've been here. I have not been without a sponsor. I need them just as much today as I did when I was first sober. I got emotionally involved, and then I started to have a few character defects. So I didn't have any before. And about 11 months of sobriety, I was going to get drunk. I hadn't had my slip yet, you know. That's all I heard. I'm glad I had my slip. And my slip meant this to me. And that's all I heard was my slip. I called Janet from the airport one night. I was about 11 months sober, and I didn't know where I was going. I had no money, no bags, but I was at the airport. That's just what I do. I show up at the airport. And she started to scream at me about writing my fourth step that I've been talking to every old-timer in the book about it. And what you do is you pick up a pencil and you sit down and you write it, or you're going to get drunk, Sharon.
And she hung up the phone.
And you know what? I went to one of those little host places, and I bought a book, a spiral notebook, and I bought a pencil, and I walked over to the window at the host place, and I bought a cup of coffee and a piece of pie, and I watched the planes come and go, and I started to write, and I started to write, and I started to write, and it came out. It happened. I started to write that fourth step. I didn't finish it that night, but I got on it. And I'll tell you, I write every inventory at the airport. I don't know what it is, if it's the jet fuel or what it is, but I write every inventory at the airport. That's where it works for me. And you know what? When I did my fifth step with my sponsor a week before my first birthday, something else happened. When they read chapter 5 and how it works, and they got to step 5, I could feel comfortable because I had done my fourth and fifth step. All my other peers had done their fourth and fifth step months before me, it seemed like. In fact, Vince's wife, Pat, is a big part of my story because Pat has 8 days less than me. And when Pat came in crying about her husband dying of cancer, she got all of the old-timers' attention. And I was one of those newcomers that later the old-timer women told me, we were hoping you were going to make it, Sharon, but we were hoping we didn't have to get too involved, you know? I was the type of woman that you saw me a couple of weeks later and said, Sharon might make it. Look, she washed her hair. But Pat had 8 days less than me, and she had taken all the old-timers' attention. She had done her fourth and fifth step at 6 or 7 months of sobriety. And it seemed like every time they read that, how it works, and they get to step 4 and step 5, Pat would turn around and look at me. So, that little judgmental look. And when I was going to drink 11 months of sobriety and not write my fourth and fifth step, a light went on in my head. My head said, if you drink, then Pat will have more time than you. Moments don't count. I stayed sober at Pat, I'll tell you. And the neat thing is every August, Pat and I share the birthday month. We both take our cakes every August. And doesn't matter why you're here. Doesn't matter what drove you in the doors. Doesn't matter. What matters is what you do. What matters is if you take these steps, you work these steps. You don't read them and think about them and ponder them. How it worked takes a little bit of work. And I had built up a little, just an ounce of self-worth, just an ounce when I took that first year birthday cake. And I was the type of newcomer that would tip gas station attendants when it was, you know, when it was their job, back when it was their job. I had $2, I walk into your store, I'd spend $2 because I'm breathing your air. I had no self-worth. And I got a little bit by working the steps. Now I got emotionally involved and these defects started happening. I started having to look at me and not him. It was really, I thought they were rubbing off on me is what I thought. I had no idea that was me. I was uncovering and discovering. Now what do I do with it? You know, and Janet and I, we wrote about them. We read them. She went to speak, I think it was in Newport, and I read them to her. And it was some simple little things, but it made me embarrassed, and I felt like she couldn't help me. And she helped me, and we went home, and I did things like imagine her in the other room when I was talking to my husband. That worked. I was nicer to him when I talked to him. I imagined she was in the other room listening to me. And so I got a little bit nicer at home. I got a little less angry. I started to look at me. I got a better job. About 2 years of sobriety, I got a better job. I got married in Alcoholics Anonymous, and my father and my mother and my two sisters came. And we got two ex-Catholics married by a Baptist minister. We had a day at a time put in the vows, till death do you part. We had a rock band and a party, and we had a lot of fun. And my father looked at me and he said, Sharon, if you ever think of what you were doing before, think twice because you've got it made. And that was approval. My father approved of what I was doing for the first time ever. And you know what? I knew I didn't do it alone. I knew it was because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had a little bit of self-worth. And it was just like the icing on the cake. It wasn't the whole cake. And as time went on, I got a wonderful sponsor named Ginny, and Ginny taught me something about making amends. And I got to go back to New Orleans at the International when I was 5 years sober, and I got to go walk back into that town as an example of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had 50 of my group with me, so I felt safe, but I was an example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I stood in front of my ex-roommate, Denny, for 5 minutes, and she didn't even recognize me. And Robin was working at that Hyatt Hotel, and I got to see Robin. She was, her eyes were going every single which way, and I got to talk to her. And they knew why I was there, and they knew I was sober, and that was all there was to it. I was an example. And this April, Robin had 5 years of sobriety. And last October, Denny had 5 years of sobriety and just passed her bar exam. And a couple of people are dead, and a couple of people are still out there. But this is a very powerful program, just by the example of who we are out there in the world, and even when nobody's looking. My marriage was really great for a long time, and then we got kind of, I don't know, he started wearing the black hat, I started wearing the white hat, and it got a little weird. I started to become Miss AA, and he started to go to flotation tanks and punk rock concerts, and we were two strangers living in this house, and you know, I woke up one morning, and he had white hair on a pierced ear, and I said, hello, what's your name? And you know, we were just in two different worlds. I went to Al-Anon to learn to release him, because I thought release meant reject. You know, I thought it meant locking him out of the house and telling him what he should and shouldn't do. And I just left him alone and went about my business of Alcoholics Anonymous. And something happened, and he came back, and he didn't drink, and he recommitted to Alcoholics Anonymous, and we started to go backpacking together, because we did that well. We didn't argue when we backpacked. We started to go backpacking together. We got Snake River up in the High Sierras. We got rained in, and it was 3 or 4 days in there. And we just survived together, and we became friends again, and we talked to one another. And I got pregnant. I mean, I don't know, but I didn't know that could happen to me, because I had never really not tried. And I had a wonderful 9 months of pregnancy. I was healthy. I played volleyball at the yard. I go to the yard every Saturday, which is Clancy's backyard. I play volleyball. I had a little camaraderie. And I played volleyball till he dropped. I mean, I just had the best time. And I was secretary of our meeting, and I grew every week at the door. I'd stand at the door and shake hands, and I'd get further away from you, because I just grew, and I was happy and healthy, and my life was good. I was working with newcomers, and I was giving it away. I was making my amends. They seemed to be continual, my amends. My sponsor, Jenny, said, how's the relationship with your father? I said, well, it's okay. I did the written amends, and we talk, and it's okay. And I go home and see him every couple of years. And she said, you owe me any money, Sharon. Well, how did she know? We forgot about that, didn't we? And she said, well, call him and ask him how much, and we'll talk about what we can do. So I called him and asked him how much. I thought we'd say, well, I'll get back to you, Sharon. But Frank had this figure right at the top of his head that he shot it right out there. And I told Jenny, and I thought it was a little high, but she said, we'll go with it. She said, what can you afford every month? And so I told her about what, and so we upped it a little bit. And I called my dad back and said, okay, I'm going to send you a check every month, and this is what I have to do for my program. And he said, fine. I said, okay. I thought he'd say, forget it. It's been too long. He said, fine. So every month I sent out this check, and she said, oh, by the way, include a note about your life and what you're doing with your life in this check. So I would include this note about my life, what I was doing with my life. My dad got this check and this note every month. You know, and about year three of doing this, I said to Jenny, I said, you know, I had been writing payment numbers down there in double colors on the left-hand side, so maybe he'd spot I'm overpaying him or something. Because she wouldn't let me call him and ask him how much more. And I write payment number 32 in big green letters or something. She said, well, he's putting into a trust fund for you, Sharon. Just send it to him. You can finally buy that Jaguar you want, you know. So I send it off. My dad didn't know why I'm sending it. He just got the check and the note every month consistently. You know, I was an example of Alcoholics Anonymous to my father by making this amends step. And then he called me one Christmas and he said, Merry Christmas, Sharon. You don't have to send any more checks. He said, but don't stop sending me the notes. By writing that check and that note every month that I didn't want to do, by having my father call me and telling me Merry Christmas that year, I cut away that baggage. We cut away that baggage. And I am able to be with my father, his little girl, today. That I was never, ever able to be. And what a freedom that is. for me. And he likes me a lot better now than I ever was before. I had this little boy, and it was another one of those events in Alcoholics Anonymous you don't do alone. You know, I went into labor early in the morning. There was his sponsor waiting at the hospital. There was a family photographer who was another sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous there. I had two babies hanging out the door and one in there. The nurse stuck her head in and said, the yard called, they wish you well. It was something I didn't do alone, you know. And she came in and she said, do you want anything for pain? The nurse said, I said, not right now, you know. And she never came back. It was quite an experience. It was something I never thought I wanted to do, was to be a mother. When that little boy was born with all his fingers and toes, and I took hundreds and hundreds of hits of LSD searching for truth, along with my alcohol and drug abuse, you know. When that little boy was born with all his fingers and toes, he touched a part of me that only God had touched before. And he's a gift, as is my sobriety. If I am not sober, I am not a good mother. If I am not sober, I don't have a job to worry about. If I am not sober, I don't have to worry about going to buy the groceries. If I am not sober, I don't have to worry about making my commitments. Alcoholics Anonymous is first and foremost in my life because it has to be if I want to live, period. It's not a moral issue with me. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I am a good mother. I treat him like a newcomer. He's 4.5 years old. And he's defiant and angry and wonderful and brilliant and all those things rolled into one. And when I can get down to his level and be at his level and treat him like a newcomer and be his pal, you know, he's got some wonderful characteristics, you know. He tells me things like, Mom, God's in my heart. I thought, yeah, where'd he hear that? You know, when I go off to these nursery school parties where we have birthdays with the normal mothers and me, the only single parent now, with my child, and they all sing happy birthday, and the kid blows out the candles, and my son keeps singing, keep coming back, you know? I got divorced in 86. Jerome was talking about that. Babs was talking about that. Danny was talking about that. You know, Vince, we've all gone through it. We've all walked through life's problems, and I haven't done it alone. I'll tell you, when my husband left in 1986, and I was happy being a housewife and a mother and content for the first time in my life, really content, and the rug was pulled on my life, I thought, oh, my God, I don't want to drink. I didn't think of I have to drink. I don't want to drink. What can I do? And I had to let him go. I couldn't hang on his leg with one arm and talk to the newcomer on the phone with the other. You know, I have to practice these principles in all my affairs. And I had a little bit of self-worth. And I didn't lay down and beg him to stay because he didn't want to. Thank God somebody left. The marriage had gone awry. It had been that way. And I hated him for a year. I really did. Nobody got custody of the meeting, and I had to see him at these meetings. And he'd circle his wagons, and I'd circle my wagons, and around this time, too, the woman that was my sponsor, Jenny, had gotten off this plane in Paris. I went to pick her up with my new baby. That was in 85, and she was supposed to be celebrating 21 years that August, and she had 21 days, and I had to get a new sponsor. Yeah. Jenny's doing fine today. She has almost 5 years, but I had to get a new sponsor. And Clancy became my sponsor because I had been walking behind him in that Pacific group, learning how to live life, learning how to show up, learning how to be active, learning how to give it away. You know, I thought, okay, this guy's in the trenches and he seems comfortable. And so I want somebody down here in the trenches with me. And he became my sponsor and he walked me through that. I was like a basket case newcomer for a year, you know. I spoke at places in Alcoholics Anonymous where all I did was stand in front of them and cry, and they loved me, and they cared about me. And I would go to my Saturday night meeting and just be insane. I just want to. One night, Clancy happened to be in town at Saturday night meeting, and he saw me across the room with two cups of hot coffee because I had spotted across the room my ex-husband and his new girlfriend, and I wanted to go over with my two cups of hot coffee and see how spiritual they were. And he spotted that look on my face that night. And he walked over to me and he set the coffee down and he grabbed me by the shoulders and he said, Sharon, you will walk through this with dignity and grace so you can be an example for others. And I thought, this example stuff in here, it always gets me. And I said, okay, and I surrendered. I gave up the extra set of keys to the car. I was going to drive his car in the ocean, my ex's car. I gave it up. You know, somebody said, Sharon, you've been walking around here judging him. Look at what happens when you point the finger. One of them points at him and three of them point at you. So get to work on yourself. I mean, these people in Alcoholics Anonymous weren't kind to me, you know. They didn't want to hear my poor me self-pity crap and thank God because I'd be drunk. Once I start to believe that I'm different, and as Vince says, if I would start to justify it, and God, betrayal is a good one. That's a good one, and I'm a perfect victim. I look good in black, and I wear it well, you know? But nobody wanted to hear that crap. They said, oh, Sharon, just keep doing what you're doing. Put one foot in front of the other. You know, I had to go through this attorney. I had to do a lot of things. My father came out here. My father wrote me out a check for the attorney. Free and clear. I didn't even have to ask for it. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. That is Alcoholics Anonymous. And he didn't want anything back for that. That was a gift from him to me. And I walked through this divorce with some dignity and some grace. And I'm so grateful I did because nobody got drunk. He had 14 years in March. My son is happy. He's not damaged by anything. Last Christmas, my ex got married to somebody last year, and last Christmas she did, and I did, and he did. We all exchanged Christmas presents, you know. Only in Alcoholics Anonymous and only with the program, really, is this possible. And she gave me a beautiful vase, and he gave me tarot cards. We gave them a Grateful Dead candle, so that's what they wanted. But we're friends today. You know, we don't go over and exchange. We don't have dinner. They just had a new baby. My son is so happy. He has a brother. It's good. Life is good. I could have blown it all, but for the grace of God and but for the fellowship, because these people stood me up and held me up and marched me through it whether I wanted to or not, because they loved me and they believed in me. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. So some days I need you, some days you need me. You know, and as Jerome said, when that hand reaches out, I want to be there. And sometimes my hand has to reach out. I have learned to ask for help. I have learned to walk through the swamp. You know, to get to the other end of the swamp takes just as much work as turning around and going where I started. And I'm a curious sort of drunk. I want to know why I was in the gosh darn swamp. You know, I want to know. I learn things in retrospect. I don't learn things as I'm walking through them. Oh, I'm feeling this, I'm learning that. I just keep walking and showing up. And afterwards, I kind of know why, because it's always better. Because God wants for me more than I want for myself most of the time. It's all a preparation. It's all a cleaning house and preparing for the next thing. And I came to you August 20th, 1975, a derelict, bloated, hopeless alcoholic. You didn't make me sit in the kitchen because I didn't look good or I didn't smell good. You sat me up front where you were proud of me. You raised my hand and you gave me hope. You gave me a program called the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You gave me a big book and you said, this is what you do. This is how we have recovered. It's yours. What you do with it is up to you. It is for fun, for free here, but what you do with it is up to you. A friend gave me a plaque. It said, what you are is God's gift to you, but what you do with your life is your gift to God. And I hope that I can continue walking like I talk, because I have babies that watch me, you know. I've got babies that were so drunk that I tied their shoe at their first meeting so they wouldn't trip out the door, that flew me out to their wedding in New Jersey where I got to do the spiritual readings at the Mass. I've got babies that are walking through something. They're sitting in, I've got one baby sitting in jail right now, sober, doing her time that she had to do for her third 502. And she's sober and she's calling me. You know, when somebody calls me at 12 at night, I get up and I listen and I tell them how I have recovered. I share my experience, strength, and hope because that's all I've got. That's it. That's who I am. I am a product of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am really happy to be here with you in Oregon. I really thought that maybe Oregon was the answer at one time. But you know what? The answer is in a sponsor, the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, a loving God, and all of you in the fellowship. And thank you very much for having me today.